Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with China's President Xi Jinping abolishing term limits and declaring himself the unrivaled helmsman of China for years to come. Orville Schell, the director of the Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations and author of Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, joins us to discuss the growth of illiberal regimes around the world, with authoritarian leaders like Xi Jinping, Putin, and Erdogan grabbing power and holding onto it ruthlessly and permanently. We will assess the absence of any pushback in defense of democratic ideals and values coming from the traditional bulwark of democracy, the United States, whose leader, Donald Trump, does not care for or defend democratic values, but instead is infatuated with dictators and demagogues. And although Xi Jinping has vowed to restore the Middle Kingdom to its rightful place as a global power, he presides over a corrupt Communist Party and a brittle economy, which, if internal pressures were to erupt, the fear is the aggressive nationalism that Xi champions could find expression in Chinese military assertion in the South China Sea and against Taiwan. Then we'll speak with a leading intelligence historian and expert on the NSA, Matthew Aid, the author of The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. He joins us to discuss the testimony today before the Senate Armed Services Committee by Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, who was also head of Cyber Command. In response to questions from senators about why the U.S. has not responded to cyber attacks from Russia that continue and will impact the 2018 elections, Admiral Rogers admitted that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has shown no interest or inclination to do anything, and that the Russians, quote, have not paid a price that is sufficient to change their behavior. Then finally, we'll examine the peculiar phenomenon of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, attacking a candidate who is one of seven running for Congress in the Democratic primary in the Texas 7th Congressional District in Houston. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, joins us to discuss the unnecessary and suicidal but continuing battle between the Democratic Party's progressive Bernie Sanders and centrist Hillary Clinton wings, and his article at The Guardian, "The Democratic Party is Now Publicly Attacking Progressive Candidates." And joining us now is Orville Schell, who was formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley and is currently the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of China's Leader. And his latest book, co-authored with John Delury, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Orville Schell.
Pleasure.
And Xi Jinping appears to have declared himself helmsman of China for life. He has obviously created a kind of cult of personality, this avuncular character. But the impression one gets is that there's a kind of illiberal coalition developing around the world with the Xi Jinpings and the Vladimir Putins and the Erdogans, etc. Do you see it in that broader context that democracy is in retreat? And least of all, Donald Trump is not standing up for democracy.
Yes, well, I do think it's a combination of the keystone of the liberal democratic arch falling out, which has traditionally been America in the guise of Donald Trump. And then, of course, these other leaders around the world, from Duterte, Erdogan, Putin, now Xi Jinping. So I think there's a kind of a double jeopardy here. And I think for anyone who does believe in sort of liberal democratic values, it's a time for some alarm.
So if you go back, though, to Tiananmen, which was largely inspired, from my understanding, from the death of Hu Yaobang and Zhao Jing, it seemed like a fairly liberal type of leader. Did somehow the ball get dropped then, or was that just a foregone conclusion that the hardliners will come back?
Well, I think the tragedy of 1989 was that while the people demonstrating were justified in their demands for, you know, greater openness and freedom of speech, et cetera, it did sadly put an end to the reform sort of efforts that were quite advanced in the 1980s. It really attenuated them. And then in the 90s, China did return a little to that sort of frame of mind. But under Xi Jinping, who really is, I think, his formative years were during the Cultural Revolution, and he never went abroad. He never studied outside of China, doesn't speak a foreign language. So his toolbox is pretty much what he brought with him from the 60s and the 70s when Mao and his revolution was still in full force. And so we see actually that, you know, revolutions are not epiphenomenal. And one reformer like Deng Xiaoping waving a wand does not sort of remove them from the sort of genome of a country. Decades of revolution sinks deep into a country's being. And now we see it re-expressing itself in a different form with Xi as a, you know, now that he can stay in office for pretty much as long as he likes if he's not overthrown in some way. So this is a kind of a tragedy of, you know, reminding us that a revolution, when it's over, is not over. And we saw the same thing in China. Gorbachev did not put to rest all of the communist experience in Russia. We see it coming back in kind of a mutant form in Putin.
Well, of course, famously, Gorbachev visited China at the time of Tiananmen. And my understanding is that the Chinese hardliners, Xi included, basically the anathema is glasnost. In other words, they're prepared to have perestroika, which is economic opening, which is what China's done, but not glasnost. And of course, I think somewhat naively, the KGB, you know, basically put Gorbachev up because they saw the statistics. They recognized the country was going to hell. And the idea of glasnost was to inspire perestroika, but the Chinese figured, no way, they're not going to allow that political opening. They'll allow economic opening, but not political opening. Is that, you think, a valid interpretation?
Yes, I think, I mean, I remember vividly in 1989 during the demonstrations when Gorbachev arrived, there were banners that said, you know, where is China's Gorbachev? Where is our reformer? And when the Chinese Communist Party put down the demonstrations and the massacre of June 3rd and 4th, it did take that lesson with it, that if you open up a little bit, if you allow political reform, you'll have a very difficult time putting on the brakes. People will want more and more and more. So Gorbachev did become the sort of anti-Christ, the anti-model of exactly what China should not do. And I think Xi Jinping has sort of taken that notion to a higher stage, if you will, recognizing that China's best prospects, in his view, of developing stably and being able to economically keep high rates of growth is to have very, very strong leadership in an authoritarian mode. And that's what he has affected, and now that's what he's assured will continue on for at least another 10 years.
So it looks as if the Chinese hardliners were successful in diverting China's youth away from aspirations towards democracy to materialism and nationalism. And that seems to be certainly what Xi Jinping is pushing hard, right? Particularly nationalism.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that, the sort of secret of the restoration of the party after 1989 was a strong measure of economic growth. And we always assumed that economic growth and political reform would have to go together. And I think the Chinese Communist Party has disproven that. And so we see the whole legitimacy of the Communist Party resting on its ability to have a kind of crypto-marketized, revolution. But it's, you know, a very fragile, very brittle system at this point. Successful, yes. But it depends on larger and larger quotients of control to keep it from running off the rails. And I think that the challenge will come when ultimately it must. The economy takes a dip, and every economy cycles. It's inevitable. And now China, of course, is vulnerable to outside ups and downs in global economic capital flows as it is to what happens in its own country. And then I think we will see a very grave test of the party because its legitimacy is not broadly based beyond sort of its own ability to deliver economic success.
But hasn't it sort of become, as the Communist Party in the Soviet Union became, a kind of corrupt and decrepit mafia? I mean, in the rural areas, I thought the communist bosses were corrupt and incompetent. You do seem to have two parallel governments there, an attempt at a kind of civic government and even a legal system, but then you've got the Communist Party running in parallel, and he's trying to bring it back. I think in Putin's case, he's even reviving Stalin. Do you think Xi Jinping is going to revive Mao?
Well, I think Xi Jinping's version of Mao will be somewhat different. No class struggle, you know, less ideological in a strictly Marxist sense. But it's more Leninist than it is Marx. I mean, Lenin was not about social revolution, class warfare, and things like that. It was about party structure, hierarchy, obedience, discipline. In other words, how do you run a tightly organized sort of single-party system? And that's what Xi Jinping wants for China. So I think to describe him as a Leninist, not a Marxist, both of those, of course, come under the rubric of communism. And this is sort of the new model around the world, although they don't call it Leninism. Whether it can be successful is the great, this is the great sort of Petri dish experiment of the 21st century.
Well, one of the signs of insecurity or perhaps even failure of the system in terms of this sort of hybrid between communism and capitalism seems to be the capital flight. And that would indicate that even the beneficiaries of economic opening are not entirely confident in investing in China. Is that really a bigger problem as it is? Because the young princelings have all kinds of fortunes. They send their kids over to educate over here and buy property and get green cards, etc. And it seems to be quite a phenomenon that's happening also in Canada and in Australia. That doesn't indicate a confidence in the future of China, at least amongst those that have been the beneficiaries of the economic opening in China.
Over the last 5 years or so, China has had the so-called going out policy, which has actually encouraged companies to become multinational, to go abroad, to invest, to sort of expand China's footprint, not envious of all the multinational corporations of the West. Lately, however, in the last year and a half, there was such an outpouring of capital that the party got extremely alarmed. And it was leaving China precisely because I think there was great uncertainty about the future of the country in many different ways, partially to do with Xi's more authoritarian rule, but also the sort of highly volatile situation, the stock market crash of a year and a half ago, what we see in some of the big companies like Anbang, which bought the Waldorf Astoria and now has been put under government management, the Hainan Airways, you know, very over-leveraged companies that are sort of have Chinese characteristics in their sort of mutant quality. So I think all of these things have created a sense of uncertainty. So people with money do want to at least get an anchor to windward and get some of it out of the country, get a house abroad, get a green card, get a passport, get their kids educated elsewhere. And I think that does tell you something about people's assessment of the future of the system as it presently exists.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Orwell Shell, what's your sense then of the militancy in terms of Xi Jinping's, you know, he's taken over the military. He comes, I think his father was involved with the military, and he's always been a party man. His father was a party man. He's trying to hold the country together via this corrupt Communist Party. And what happens if, as you say, it's a brittle system? If it starts to crack up, will he turn to foreign military adventurism? Will they amp up the occupation of those man-made islands, et cetera, and do other things that could bring them into some kind of clash, either with their Asian neighbors, the South Koreans and the Japanese, or even the United States?
Well, I think the first refuge of, the country will be and has been in nationalism, to sort of unify people by inflaming them with a sense of love of country. And then should that fail, I think one could expect them to do some kind of adventure, perhaps with Taiwan or Hong Kong, which is sort of foreign but not foreign. And then I think, if they really needed to sort of galvanize people with some outside threat, of course, there's always Japan. The Chinese have never loved because of its savage occupation of the Chinese mainland in World War II, and the contested islands of Sengoku, Diaoyudao, in the East China Sea. So I think there are plenty of targets. And then, of course, there's the United States, which is a long historical complexity of attraction, repulsion, love, and hate. And this also has been traditionally, over the last 100 years, a sort of a way that different governments have been able to use sort of in nascent, incipient Chinese anti-foreignism against the United States as a superpower to rally people at home. So there's great dangers in this. And I think precisely China's own weakness at home, such as it is, does make them very susceptible to nationalism and some kinds of foreign adventure.
Well, Orville, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Orville Schell, who is formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley and is currently the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of China's Leader. And his latest book, co-authored with John DeLury, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the testimony today before the head of the NSA and Cyber Command about how Donald Trump has not done anything about Russian cyber attacks on America, and we'll ask the question why.
Depends on who. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. On a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matthew Aid, a leading intelligence historian, an expert on the NSA, and a regular commentator on intelligence matters for the New York Times, the Financial Times, the National Journal, the Associated Press, CBS News, and many other outlets. He is the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he also has a forthcoming book about the NSA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Aid.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Matthew, today, Admiral Rogers, the head of the NSA, is also head of Cyber Command, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And what he said should be alarming to all Americans. He basically, in being questioned about what is the Trump administration's response to Russia's attacks on the United States in terms of cyber warfare, information warfare, etc. And, of course, that includes the recent indictments by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, of over a dozen Russians for spreading disinformation during the U.S. election with the intent of helping Donald Trump get elected. So the evidence is out there, and a couple of Democratic senators, Jack Reed among them, said, what are you doing? And he said, basically nothing. And then when they asked Admiral Rogers about whether the Trump administration had tasked him to do anything, he said essentially no, they haven't. So that leads one to ask the question of why is Donald Trump being completely passive in the face of this overwhelming evidence that the United States has been attacked?
The short answer is, I have not a clue. It defies reason, logic, and common sense that we are not taking steps to defend, you know, our country against the ongoing. I mean, it's, you know, everybody knows that. I think everybody accepts, even people of conservative bent believe that Russia did meddle in our 2016 election, but it hasn't stopped there. The Russians are still playing, you know, what the Russians call active measure games here in the United States. They're, as recently as the Parkland school shootings in Florida, you know, hundreds of Russian bots suddenly became active and started spreading rumors and innuendo about the teenagers who have been out protesting, you know, taking stands in support of the National Rifle Association. You know, I mean, it's the Russians are still trying to sow division and disunity in this country, and, you know, and the Trump administration is doing absolutely nothing. And but to be fair, it's not just the White House. According to the testimony of Admiral Rogers, who is concurrently the director of NSA and U.S. Cyber Command, which is responsible for defending the United States against cyber attacks from countries like Russia and China et al., he said that there's been no guidance coming from the Pentagon, from General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, as well, which is even more alarming given the fact that, you know, General Mattis is, you know, he's supposed to be a sort of a tough, no-nonsense guy who doesn't, you know, doesn't brook, you know, foreign interference in the United States at all. So, you know, the lack of responsiveness by the entire U.S. government on this point is really mind-boggling.
And since you're a student of the NSA and by extension Cyber Command, Matthew Aid, the assumption would be that after the billions and billions we spent, and of course we've had to spend an extra several billions to make up for the damage from the Snowden leaks and the other leak via shadow brokers, nevertheless, the assumption is that the U.S. has a considerable cyber arsenal. And again, Admiral Rogers, he bristled at the idea that U.S. is sitting on our hands and waiting, but he admitted that we have not opted to engage in some of the same behavior we are seeing with regard to Russia. And then he said they have not paid a price that is sufficient to change their behavior. So what do you know that of what we could be doing to deter the Russians from their current attacks, and presumably as the November election gets nearer, they'll get more active?
Well, if you and your listeners will recall, a few years back, the North Koreans hacked the computers of Sony Pictures in Hollywood and stole lots and lots of emails, lots of salacious details suddenly were leaked to the newspapers about various actors and directors. One actress who does a lot of action films was described in one email as being a talentless hack. Well, guess what? A few days after the attack on the Sony Picture computers became a matter of public record, all the computers in North Korea suddenly went dead. Somebody hit the entire North Korean communications grid with a cyber attack. It was not very well publicized at the time, but it did happen, and it lasted, you know, somewhere along the lines of 2 to 3 days. And this, you know, it's been widely rumored in intelligence circles that this was the United States striking back at North Korea for, you know, what they had done here in the United States. So clearly, you know, even a country as secretive and as insular as North Korea can be hit with a cyber attack, you know, given the weapons that are currently, you know, in the arsenal of the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command. Now, that all that said, why, you know, what bars the United States from taking similar action against Russia or against China? You know, in the case where, you know, we can literally watch these people gearing up for an attack. We can see their activity on the, you know, on the dark web as they fish around looking for IP addresses and, you know, seeking ways to attack our systems. And we have proactively, you know, done things against both Russian and Chinese hackers, but it just, it's done very, very quietly, very covertly. But in the case of Russia, where their activities have risen to the point where, I mean, a state of war, a cyber war, if you want to call it, now exists between the United States and the Russian Federation. Why haven't we done anything? I'm not suggesting that, you know, we take out all the computers in Moscow, just as our way of saying, you know, hello, you know, we don't like what you're doing over here on this side of the Atlantic, but we have the ability proactively, if we see the Russians, you know, gearing up for an attack, we can stop it without, you know, doing anything, you know, overly provocative. But, you know, we do have the ability, we do have the weapons in our arsenal to do something. And, but, you know, the fact is that what Admiral Rogers was saying in testimony today is not only has he not been given a green light to do anything, but he hasn't even been asked what, if anything, the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command could do to prevent future attacks. And this is it's disturbing also because our midterm elections are coming up in November of this year. Everyone believes the Russians are going to interfere or attempt to meddle in those elections, and we're still not doing a damn thing.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Aid, who's a leading intelligence historian and expert on the NSA. He's the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he has a forthcoming book also about the NSA. Well, that hasn't, of course, stopped the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders from in questioning today about Admiral Rogers' testimony. She said that nobody is denying him the authority to take action. We have focused on a variety of different ways, et cetera. And then she went on to blame the Obama administration and say that Trump had been harder on Russia than Obama was. So this is the peculiar Alice in Wonderland nature of this current government. But unfortunately, a big chunk of the American population actually believed Trump. And it's so obvious that the Republican Party has thrown their lot behind him, and they're prepared to essentially go along with what, to many, appears to be treason.
I know. It's if Ronald Reagan were alive today, he would roll over in his grave. It's bizarre. I have to say, since I grew up and briefly served, you know, as an intelligence analyst during the Cold War era, when Russia was then the Soviet Union, and they were the enemy. And a lot of the people who are now ignoring the Russian threat, you know, simply because, you know, Donald Trump doesn't think they're, you know, they now thinks they're the good guys, and they couldn't possibly have done anything wrong. Once thought completely differently about Moscow, Kremlin, you know, and Vladimir Putin. So I have not been able to get my head around, you know, this, you know, dysfunctional attitude on the part of, you know, 33% of the American public who follows Donald Trump's, feelings about, about Russia and Vladimir Putin's intent.
So it's obvious, and it's been obvious for some time, that Putin and the Russians have had a jump on us, at least maybe in the sense that they're prepared to cross that line. And, of course, in information warfare and hybrid warfare that they perfected, it is short of kinetic activity, which it means that it sort of goes under the radar. But that doesn't mean it's not effective. And it's clearly been incredibly effective, particularly if they foisted this catastrophic president on us, Donald Trump. Then that is a huge coup. If Putin's intention is to weaken America, he's found the perfect candidate to do so in Donald Trump. And this goes on a daily basis, as we all witness. But the question would be, though, when we talk about Admiral Rogers bristling today about saying we're not sitting on our hands, but on the other hand, we haven't, you know, the president hasn't told him to do anything, and you were just saying the Secretary of Defense also hasn't told anybody in Cyber Command or NSA to do anything. So if we're keeping our powder dry, is that because if you go down this path of retaliation, it gets very, very tricky? Because, for example, the shadow brokers, that massive hack that came out of the NSA, those hacking tools provide Russia and China and North Korea and others with the ability to completely disrupt the United States. I mean, it's an irony that we created them, or at least our intelligence services created them, and then they got lost to the other side, and now the other side has the potential to use them against us. So if you go down the path of retaliation, isn't that incredibly hazardous?
I can see the point. It sounds like something I've heard expressed by State Department diplomats in the past who have opposed rather consistently, I would think, you know, using the cyber weapons that we now possess, you know, in much the same way that they would oppose the use of tactical nuclear weapons, a more kinetic weapon, to use a Pentagon term. You know, I understand the argument against using these weapons, you know, for fear that, you know, if we use them, then the Russians would retaliate against that, and then we would be forced to, you know, respond in turn, and on it would go. But the fact is that the Russians have been using these weapons, you know, without any response from the United States since the late 1990s, when they used these cyber weapons against Estonia in 1997. They used their weapons extensively against the Ukraine, you know, more recently, you know, after, you know, prior to and then subsequent to the war between the Russian Federation and Ukraine over the Crimea. They have attacked British communication systems. They attempted to interfere in both the German and Dutch and French elections last year. And all of this has taken place without any response from the United States. And I hate to sound like, you know, Neville Chamberlain coming back from Munich with a piece of paper in his hand saying, "We have peace in our time." You know, we don't. I mean, the fact is that unless we do something to try and curb the Russian behavior in cyberspace, then it will get worse.
Right. But Matthew, the difference, though, was that Neville Chamberlain came out of an old tradition of diplomacy and where gentlemen told the truth, and he simply was incapable of understanding that he was dealing with a gangster when he was sitting opposite Adolf Hitler, who was lying through his teeth. Well, we have a gangster in Russia. His name is Vladimir Putin. And the really extraordinary thing is that we may have, Putin may own Trump. It's not inconceivable. You know, the evidence is mounting. And the very reason we're having this conversation is that the head of Cyber Command, the head of the NSA, told our senators today that Trump has done nothing about these attacks on us. And when you have to add that to the fact that Trump has never levied any sanctions to punish Russia for election interference, despite the fact that the Congress unanimously passed legislation that took effect in January 29, requiring him to do so, and the fact that a series of Dan Coats and the head of the FBI and now the head of the NSA and Cyber Command have all testified that Russia had disrupted the 2016 election and is trying to disrupt the 2018 midterm. So,
right,
this is
all of this is true, and all of it has gone without a response from the United States. And you know, when are we going to get up on our hind legs and say something, much less do something about this? You know, the fact of the matter is, as you correctly pointed out, you know, Congress unanimously passed, or nearly unanimously passed, expanded sanctions against Russia for its meddling in our election. And Trump opposed, you know, he made no secret of the fact that he opposed the congressional efforts to beef up the sanctions against Russia. And then after it passed, he said he was reluctantly going to sign the bill, and then he's chosen deliberately not to implement. And again, this is difficult for me to get my head around as well. You know, why is he so reluctant to chastise Vladimir Putin?
Well, it's a very ironic situation that the liberals are the ones that are calling for retaliation against Russia.
and
the conservatives are the ones that I think they're just thoroughly corrupt. They've got power. Trump is the perfect president for the oligarchy that backs the Republican Party. He'll sign anything they put in front of him. And they're all going along with the fact that they're all in, you know, going along with the denial of the obvious, which is that Russia is pulling the strings here. That is an...
And Barry, I would just add, I mean, not only has Putin's use of disinformation and psychological warfare been incredibly effective, but it's been very cost-effective in the sense that for a few million dollars, he has caused more damage and more, you know, discomfort and disunity in this country than any kinetic weapons that he
sure
could choose to employ.
Right. Well, that is because Americans are ill-educated and gullible and stupid and believe all kinds of ridiculous conspiracy theories. And Donald Trump is among those people who believe in conspiracy theories. So, you know, this is a deeper problem than just Russian interference. This is, I think, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and recognize that we are vulnerable because we're stupid.
Whatever problems our educational system is in the United States, it bothers me deeply that there is a segment of our country, not all of the country, but you know, there is a segment of the United States that refuses to accept what is going on out there. It's not that, you know, it's just the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, you know, mainstream newspapers that are reporting on this. I mean, every segment of the U.S. intelligence community knows it to be true, but we also know that Donald Trump doesn't trust the U.S. intelligence community. He doesn't read the material that he's given every morning by the Director of National Intelligence and the CIA. They won't even talk to him about Russia because he gets incredibly angry when, you know, they attempt to tell him that Russia is engaged in nefarious activities in the United States. And so, I mean, you know, the failings, you know, run from top to bottom here. And, you know, there's still so many details we don't know. And we're waiting for Robert Mueller, special counsel, who's investigating the Trump-Russia, you know, scandal, I guess is probably the appropriate word for it. We're waiting for the next series of indictments to be handed down to find out how deep the rot runs, you know, within the U.S. government.
Well, Matthew Aid, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Aid, who's a leading intelligence historian and expert on the NSA. He is the author of Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror, and The Secret Sentry, The Definitive History of the National Security Agency. And he also has a forthcoming book about the NSA. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the unnecessary and suicidal but continuing battle between the progressive Bernie Sanders and the centrist Hillary Clinton wings of the Democratic Party, with the TCCC attacking a progressive candidate running in Houston. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Digmanich, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Democratic Party is Now Publicly Attacking Progressive Candidates. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
It's always great to talk with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And it's pretty extraordinary how the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, openly attacked a liberal candidate, I think one of six running in Texas's 7th congressional district in Houston. The sort of venality with which they attacked her, and in terms of kind of opposition research, one would expect to come from the Republicans. But no, it's coming from the DCCC, and they clearly want to prevent this candidate, Laura Moser, from winning the Democratic primary. So you know her. You taught her, actually, at Amherst. Why are they so against her?
I should just emphasize my agreement with you that it really is quite an extraordinary thing for the DCCC to be doing this. You know, Laura, she was an extraordinarily gifted student. I mean, she really stands out in my mind. I've been teaching Amherst for over a quarter of a century now. I'm kind of almost embarrassed to admit. And she was a student of mine. This is now a number of years ago. She was a student in the late 90s, and she really kind of stood out as a really quite intellectually gifted student. And I should say that I have remained in contact with her, and I have contributed to her campaign. That said, it's not as if she's some kind of like a super liberal individual. She's actually someone who has staked out progressive positions on a wide range of political causes. And it is kind of really kind of astonishing the way in which the DCCC has engaged in something that really looks like a smear campaign. I mean, it's one thing to kind of raise concerns about a candidate. Obviously, we all know how desperate the Democrats are to, you know, pick up 24 seats so they can win back the House. But to see this kind of smear campaign directed against someone who, by all measures, is, you know, a very plausible, highly intelligent, very articulate, quite charismatic candidate. In fact, in many ways, you might think of Laura Moser as exactly the kind of candidate that the Democrats would want to see being brought into politics for the purposes of re-energizing and reinvigorating the party.
Well, that's what's so puzzling. At least I cannot understand why the Democratic Party has not learned from its mistakes in the 2016 election. in the division between the Hillary supporters and the Bernie supporters became so poisonous that it was completely dysfunctional. And this seems to be a continuation of that. The fact that Hillary Clinton did not embrace Bernie Sanders. One, she had to run against somebody. It couldn't just have a coronation, for God's sake. And two, why she didn't choose him as her vice president. The person she chose did absolutely nothing for her. Her people were so angry. We know about thanks to the Russians and WikiLeaks, we know that, and they obviously were trying to exploit these divisions. The divisions nevertheless remain, and I don't for the life of me understand what the problem is. You know, what's wrong with having a wing of your party attract the young people, attract energy, get people out to vote who normally don't vote, which is the big problem that Democrats have in the midterms? I just don't understand why the Bernie people and the Hillary people can't work together.
It is genuinely, you know, really quite bewildering. And again, you kind of hope that that the Democrats, that in their desire, in the understandable desire to win back the House, that they would manage to avoid two things. One, becoming completely spineless, and second, becoming completely venal. And it seems like in the case of the attacks that have been directed against Laura Moser in this, in the run-up to the primary in the 7th District of Houston in Texas, that they've managed to display both spinelessness and venality. And the spinelessness, it does seem to be like, on one level, there's an eagerness to bring in new faces, new energy, in particular, highly talented young women into the political process. At the same time, there's this kind of incredible wariness on the part, lest they believe that the young person be unable to actually see things through to victory. And so on one level, they've caught themselves in this completely untenable position. And it's an unpleasant position. You know, it's not just untenable. It's an ugly position to suddenly turn against a candidate the way they've turned against Moser.
Well, specifically what they leaked to the DCCC about Moser was that she apparently had once said that she'd sooner have my teeth pulled out without anesthesia than live in Paris, Texas. My understanding is that it was taken out of context, and it's supposed to be sort of an indication that she's too liberal for Texas voters, even though Houston did vote for Hillary Clinton, the district she's running in, the 7th Congressional District. So what's their thinking there, the DCCC? I mean, I understand the logic that if you want to flip the House and get rid of a bunch of Republicans, at least 24 of them, they are essentially, you know, you're basically running blue candidates in red states or red-leaning states. So the assumption is that you can't run a bunch of rabid liberals against Republicans in red states. You've got to run centrist Democrats. So what's wrong with that logic?
Well, I mean, first of all, the one thing is, I think if you look at Laura Moser's record, it's not as if she is a rabid liberal. And it's certainly not the case that she's like the second coming of Gus Hall or something like that. You know, I think she has, within the electorate, she has attracted, she's generated the kind of energy that Bernie Sanders did generated. But I'm not sure that I would call her, politically, I'd say politically she's somewhere between Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And, the fact that she has previously worked for many years as a journalist and writes in a humorous, over-the-top vein in a piece that she's really writing about the attractions of urban life, that she talks about that she would really not like to live in Paris, Texas, which is where her grandparents are from. I mean, she's, I think, a fifth-generation Texanian person from Texas. That the DCCC is able to drag from that evidence that she finds life in Texas disgusting. I mean, that's an awfully powerful word. In fact, the person who I most associate with calling things disgusting is our present president. I mean, he's the one who finds everything disgusting. He finds the people who fail to put their life online against someone with an automatic weapon disgusting. And it really is kind of, it's very disappointing to see the DCCC use that kind of vocabulary and twist something so out of, to tear something so out of its proper context.
Well, we know that the DCCC prefer candidates who are self-financed, and they understand, or at least they're in that mindset, that you've got to be competitive, and which means that you turn your candidates into telemarketers, and that's what happens. Congress people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, spend most of their time dialing for dollars. So if you're a good dialer for dollars, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi want you. Or if you're a multimillionaire and you can self-finance, they want you. You know, it's having some terrible... I mean, for example, out here in California, we do have a lot of vulnerable Republicans. The one that they should get rid of, I mean, they'd be doing the Lord's work if they didn't get rid of Devin Nunes. The DCCC, as far as I know, is backing a ridiculous candidate who's, I think, a lawyer who represents payday lenders, who thinks that if we have the death penalty, why don't we use it? And they're backing him instead of a young Latino community activist along the lines of Barack Obama in a heavily Latino district, which would be the only way to get rid of Nunes, is to get the Latino vote out. So some of what's going on is absolutely mystifying. It's, you know, the Republicans embraced the Tea Party, the tail that wags the dog, and they ran with it, and they've basically been taken over by the Tea Party. But on the Democratic side, they're always afraid of their own left. They run away from the left of their own party, and I don't understand that mechanism.
I agree with you. Again, you know, I think we're just in heated agreement with one another. And again, one of the things that's so bewildering, I mean, one of the things that I think one of the features of the American political landscape today is this kind of asymmetric polarization. That is, the people on the left of the Democratic Party are not nearly as left as the people on the right of the Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party, something dramatic and dramatically bad has happened to the Republican Party in recent years. And when you talk about the left in of the Democrat, you're talking about, you know, a constellation of rather progressive, sensible, intellectually defensible positions. And the idea that the Democrats are terrified that the electorate is incapable of rallying around people who have a coherent set of progressive policies and principles, it really is bewildering, and it's exceptionally disappointing. And I think, as you're suggesting, it's also ultimately probably going to be self-defeating as well.
Well, you know, after the massacre in Las Vegas, which was an extraordinary event, which is people were... I think it was, 58 people were killed by... it's just an astonishing event. The DCCC advised Democratic candidates not to discuss gun control policy after the Las Vegas shooting. Now, you know, that is mystifying, I have to say, because... And look what's happening now. It's not the DCCC that's stepping up to the plate. It's these young high school kids down in Parkland, Florida. And they're turning it into a real political movement. So, again, why run away from something that's basically you're fighting insanity, you're fighting brutality, you're fighting the most hideous form of fratricide that makes America one of the oddest countries on the planet, where we kill our own and don't do anything about it?
It is astonishing to see that, you know, the greatest acts of political courage in the United States today coming from a group of 17-year-olds. I mean, it's an astonishing thing to see. And it is unbelievable to see the Democrats kind of, you know, at least in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, walking away from an issue which, you know, after all, I mean, we need to bear in mind that the overwhelming number of Americans support sensible gun control. I mean, the statistics are really quite remarkable. I mean, it's on the order of 85 to 90% of Americans support reasonable gun control legislation. And, you know, I suppose one reality that the Democrats do have to deal with is the gerrymandering, which makes it, you know, an additionally difficult thing for them to flip these red districts. So it seems like, given the fact that they see that there's a kind of demographic disadvantage that they have to deal with, that it makes them just unbelievably tepid in their politics. And again, it's disappointing, and what I really do fear is that it's self-defeating. And we can also hope that some help will come from the courts in the form of the rejection of the gerrymandering schemes. I mean, that's something to look for. Will ultimately decided by the Supreme Court, as we know, and that could really change the political landscape quite dramatically.
Well, I can understand the DCCC cautioning Democratic candidates not to come across like ambulance chasers and jump on the bandwagon, because that does offend people, I think. But on the other hand, you can't not talk about the most important issue out there, at least one of the most important issues out there, that is just a bleeding wound in this country. I mean, it's just something that is outrageous. So that's the... and by the way, the guy that did stand up, this senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, I think he's, you know, he's actually made himself, I think, look like a leader, you know, as bad as Trump is, and he's just an absolute disgrace. But the Republicans are getting behind him. He's already chosen his campaign manager for re-election, yeah. And... let's face it, I don't see any leadership coming on the Democratic side.
Right. Well, Murphy is, you know, he's someone after Sandy Hook. He really did take an impressive leadership role. I mean, he was one who was, I think he himself describes kind of his worst day as a politician is when the Senate was unable in the wake of Sandy Hook. I mean, let's just bracket the whole question of trying to get a ban on assault weapons, just the effort to strengthen background checks. I mean, that was something that failed in the Senate, and that was an incredibly, I think, dispiriting moment for him. But to his credit, he remains, you know, very dogged in the effort to try to see rational, sensible gun control get passed in the United States. And what you mentioned earlier, I mean, sure, I mean, you don't want to politicize the issue in the wake of a mass shooting, but I also find that charge of, oh, well, if you bring up sensible, rational gun control, you're politicizing something in the wake of a tragedy. My overwhelming guess is that the grieving families of people who have lost loved ones in these mass shootings do not see this as some kind of ugly politicization as much as they see it as an attempt to galvanize a nation which has become benumbed by these kinds of events.
Exactly. When will we right wrongs? I mean, how crazy is that? I thank you for joining us, Lawrence Douglas.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Ian. Thanks again.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. He has an article at The Guardian, "The Democratic Party is Now Publicly Attacking Progressive Candidates." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.